So yesterday we left it at action theory. So we were looking at models and theories around cognition and behavior. And so you remember action theory with the 7 stages of action and this notion of distances, which can be used as quite coarse tool to assess an interface, trying to understand where some of these distances can be reduced by changing the way the user interacts with the system. And I left it saying that action theory is fine, but it's sort of, how do I say this? It sort of reflects some way of thinking that has been, I guess, supported by the cognitivist approach that considers that, you know, in a sense, our brain is a little computer, so we make plans, we make decisions, we act, we assess the result, and we act in a sense, predictable and rational way. But of course, that's an oversimplification. And as I said before, models and theories are about simplifying the real world. But sometimes you have to go and look into the complexity of it. And so if we look at the way people act in the real world, you can turn to cognitivists to look about at what's happening in our brain. You can also turn towards anthropologists who look at how people, you know, interact with each other and with their environment. So there's a whole series of theories, and in this area of social sciences, it's often called frameworks rather than theories or models that try to take this more holistic view of how people interact with their environment. And so the ethno-methodological approach, can you all say ethno-methodological? No, it took me a while to get there. So it's from ethnography, so the methodology used in ethnography, where you study a group of people in their environment, and it's been used to study, you know, populations in various areas of the world, for example. But you can apply it to studying people in their work environment. And so a number of people have conducted this detailed analysis of the work practices of people, not just looking at how fast they are typing on the computer or doing some task, but more generally how computers, what role they have in their everyday environment, how they adopt it, how they adapt it, and how what effect it has on their work practices. And the idea here is to try to understand how the computer systems in general play a role in causal chains of action, why people do the things they do instead of what they are supposed to do. And what you'll find in studies, something funny happening in the back. No, you don't want to share it. No, guess not. So one thing that we observe time and again when we do these kind of studies is that the work as it is actually done is not is very different from the work as it should be done, or as the managers, for example, think it is being done. To take one example, when you are in a plane, there are air traffic controllers on the ground that control the plane's flight, make sure that planes are not going to run into each other, and give instructions to pilots to change level, to change heading, to wait in a pattern before they can land and all these things. Needless to say, these people have a big responsibility because, in a sense, they hold in their hands the lives of hundreds or thousands of people in those planes. And of course, they're very, they have very long training to become before they can do that. And they also have a lot of rules that they need to follow to do the job. It turns out that if they did actually indeed follow all the rules and all the regulations and all that, they could not have the number of planes that they manage in the air at the same time as they actually do. It could be up to half the traffic that could not happen if they were to follow all the rules. So they adapt their job because they have the pressure of putting in the air all the planes that the companies have decided to fly and to make this work. And so when you observe their work practices, well, in a sense, they break a number of rules. At the same time, they are good at it, because if you look at, in particular in France, there is no accident that can be attributed to an error by air traffic controllers. And if you look worldwide, there is a case of a few years ago that resulted from an accident that resulted from a mistake by air traffic controllers. And the one incident that ever happened in France was during a strike when military air traffic controllers took over from the civilian ones. And because they're not used probably to managing the same type of traffic, created a, well, not really an accident, but a problem. So getting back to this, what we see is that you have many jobs where, you know, you have rules that describe what the job should do and how computers play a role in that job, like you're supposed to use that system, just in this university. I think I mentioned that before, but there is this system called Apogee, which is a system that collects all the grades and creates the transcripts that at the end of the year will, you know, be signed by the heads of the juries and decide if you get your degree or not. And we're supposed to put the grades in that system. Well, of course, in the end, we put the grades in that system because otherwise you wouldn't get your degrees, and that would be, I think, a problem. But no teaching program I know is putting the grades up front in that system. They all manage a side system with spreadsheets, typically, to do the things on the side, because there's always things that are unanticipated, some mistakes or grade missing, or a student that is not in the right, you know, column or something. And the thing is, this Apogee system is very strict. You cannot make, you know, once you have entered the grade, pretty much you cannot change it. And there are good reasons for this, because we don't want people to, you know, mess with the grades. But the result is that even though they are supposed to use this system and only that system, well, we all use systems on the side until we are sure we agree about everything, and then we can transfer it into the official system. And that happens all the time. So it is important to be able to analyze not the work practices as they are supposed to happen, but to analyze them as they actually happen. So Lucy Suchman is an anthropologist by training, and she took a job at Xerox PARC. Remember Xerox PARC? Yes? Oh, something remember suddenly. Good news. You're really in good shape on Thursday afternoon. So, what?
You mentioned Xerox at almost every lecture.
Okay, well, so repetition, learning through repetition. She was at Xerox PARC when Xerox was creating what became the GUIs that we know today. And so she was studying, as an anthropologist, the way people used technology, and in particular how they were interacting with the photocopiers, because photocopiers were the main business of Xerox at the time. And so she, you know, was looking at the fact that people don't understand the interface to the photocopier, or they come to the photocopier, they try to do something, doesn't work, they just give up, or they try to call for help, etc. And so her thesis was edited as a book, which is called Plans and Situated Actions, which is a fairly rare case of a PhD dissertation, you know, becoming a famous book, not a blockbuster kind of book, but a book really well known in the larger field of HCI. And what she showed is that human action takes place in a complex context. Everything we do is situated. Situated means it's affected by the situation we're in. So, for example, if you guys try to print something here in this building, right? Have you tried? Have you ever tried? Has anybody printed anything? You don't print anymore. You're the digital generation. No paper. So, I don't know. Maybe this is not a good example. But I'll tell you my experience when I have to print things, because I also try not to print. But sometimes, because we have all these processes where everything is done on the computer, except at the end, you need to have ink on paper. Otherwise, you know, it doesn't count. And even if you try to put your digital, your digitized signature onto a PDF and say, here it is, they say, no, we want really almost your blood on the piece of paper, otherwise it doesn't count. And so everyone said, well, I have to print things. And so I print things and I get to the printer. And sometimes the thing is just not there at the printer. Now, the thing is, if I had the plan in my head, I would have planned for what happens if the thing doesn't come out of the printer. That's the planning part. My planning part is I print, I go to the printer, I pick up the document, and I do what I have to do with it. But if I get to the printer and the document's not there, then that's where what she calls the situated action starts taking place. And it really depends on the situation. Maybe I was trying to print, for example, the sign-up sheet that's going around, and it's 5 minutes before class, so if it doesn't show up at the printer, what do I do? Well, yeah, I'm not going to wait. I said, screw it. I rush to class, and then I find a way to fix it by giving you another sheet of paper. But if I'm not in a rush, maybe I'll try to see what's going on, if there is something blocking the thing. And so the time I will invest in fixing that problem maybe will depend on how busy am I or in what mood I am. Maybe I'm in the mood to try to fix the thing, or I said, well, forget it, someone else will need it more than I do and will take the time to fix it. So we constantly adapt our behavior to the situation at hand, even though we also do some planning. So the stuff from action theory from Norman is not irrelevant. I would say it's a normal mode of behavior. But then we are easily adjusting it to the context. So if you have a plan, it's used as a guide, but you can adjust it as you go. And because you adjust your actions as you go, you also modify the context itself. And so the fact that, you know, if I try to print, things don't print well, means that next time I'll try to, you know, print it the day before at home, because my printer at home is more reliable than the one at my office. Or I will decide to organize things differently to avoid that the situation happens again. So in the in parallel with this class, there's a class that's called Fundamentals of Situated Interaction that we're teaching with Wendy to the M2 HCID students. And so what we look is, how can we design interfaces that take into account the fact that people act in a situated way? This goes against things like task analysis. Has anybody here heard about task analysis? Yes. We don't like task analysis, I'm sorry. no, I know. but task analysis is a concept that comes from ergonomics. Ergonomics and human factors. And something that's probably useful to know is that in the larger community that works on how we interact with technology, there is this kind of big divide between, on the one hand, ergonomics and human factors, and on the other hand, what we call human-computer interaction. The origin of ergonomics is Taylorism. Taylorism, does that ring a bell for anyone? Yes?
The industrial process that developed in the late 90s, early 20s, I don't remember exactly.
Yes? So
the idea was to build things in chain where everyone was specialized in one part
right.
of the task.
So that's so Taylorism comes from the name of a guy, Taylor, at the time where indeed the industrial revolution created the notion of a chain. The most famous one is Henry Ford's chain to build the Ford T, one of the first mass-produced cars, and where they found out that people were more efficient at building the car if they had very specialized jobs that they did very repeatedly, rather than having, you know, three people or four or whatever it took all together to build one car, and each one having to be able to do a little bit of everything. And so Taylor actually did all this analysis and studies of I take a pile of dirt here, I take the stronger worker in the factory, I give him a shovel, and I said, move that pile of dirt here, and I measure how long it takes. And then I will decide, well, you know, this is the reference time for someone to do this task. So it was really into measuring how efficient people could be at doing a particular task and trying to optimize things from the perspective of the production line as opposed to from the perspective of the well-being of the workers. Now, of course, he also realized that it was a good thing for the companies to give better working conditions to the workers, because otherwise they are less productive, or they fall sick, or they leave the job. So he also created a lot of things to improve work conditions. And ergonomics essentially came out of there. It was ergonomics. Ergo is Greek for work, and ergonomics means you're measuring and assessing and measuring work. And so the field of ergonomics and human factors has shifted or has added a part on what's called cognitive ergonomics, which was this ergonomics principle of how do you make work the most efficient possible. To cognitive ergonomics, where the work is easy, not on the physical side of how much effort or what is the best tool to do this particular task, but to the perspective of cognitive task. And the word cognitive load, for example, comes out of that, reducing the cognitive load. Now, in ergonomics, in cognitive ergonomics, there is this notion that you want to analyze the tasks that people do. So if someone is responsible for taking invoices in a company, they're going to look at, well, to take an invoice, you need to collect this type of information. So we need a system so you can enter that information and then figure out who is going to process it and all that. And they create what they call task models, which are descriptions and sort of a block diagrams. Say, well, you have to do this, and then you have to do that. And then you can try to sort of optimize these processes. And the result of task analysis is combined with a whole bunch of rules, ergonomic rules, saying you should do this, you should not do that when you design an interface. And some of these rules are fairly, you know, are similar to the ones I cited about consistency, about minimizing the amount of things you need to keep in memory to do your task, and et cetera. And so they make sense in the design process. But in a sense, my critique of this approach is that it assumes that people actually do the tasks in the way they are described. And usually, the descriptions of the tasks don't come from the workers themselves, but typically from their managers, who say, well, you know, this is the task that they should be doing. But in reality, that's not the way it works. Getting back to my example of the air traffic controllers, at the time that we were doing this study, Wendy spent hours and hours in the air traffic control center observing the air traffic controllers. There was a big project to replace these paper flight strips that they were using to keep track of which flights are in the air with a completely electronic system where everything should be would be on the screen as opposed to in those physical pieces of paper. And at some point, she went to visit an air traffic control center in Maastricht, which is sort of at the border between Luxembourg, probably Germany and France, and I think there's four countries there, right?
Belgium.
Yeah. Which is kind of compared to the traffic in the Paris area, is very small. I mean, they have flights going east to west and flights going north south. And someone is being attacked. Okay? And so, where was I? Yeah, and so they were very proud because they had gotten rid of these paper flight strips. Well, it really likes you, I don't know. Yeah. I'm distracted now. So they were very proud because they had gotten rid of the paper flight strip and they had an all electronic system where everything was done online by clicking on menus on the screen. But the thing is that when you looked at the way they actually worked, you realized that on the desks, they had piles of the old flight strips that were unused, that were turned over on the non-printed side, where they were keeping notes by hand. And that's the thing where you have to realize, well, you know, something went wrong in the design of this system, because they're so very proud, the managers are very proud that, you know, there are this all computer-based air traffic control, but no, people to do their job, they still need to write things down to keep track of things. So again, the way things are done in the real world are never the way that they're supposed to be done or they are prescribed in a sense. And so the idea of situated action is to look at this, because it's by looking at why people are not doing it the way they are supposed to do it, that's where there is room for improvement. That's where there is room for design, for creating better systems. Now, another theory or framework in that space is called activity theory. So now don't be confused between action theory and activity theory. These are two very different things. So it's called activity theory, and it comes out of Russia, or the former Soviet Union, I guess, originally. And so there were psychologists there, social psychologists, who were working on analyzing human activity. So Vygotsky and Leontief are sort of the fathers of this field. And so they were looking at it from a perspective of how labor is, so human activity, work, is organized in a community. So going from, you know, not focusing on one person doing one thing, but sort of a larger, a more, again, more holistic view of things. And one sort of basic idea behind this theory is that if you analyze human activity, the relationship between the subjects, so the people, and the object, the things they do, or they're supposed to do, is mediated by tools. You know, having to type things on a typewriter to create memos, to take orders, or to do things like this. So you have tools between the human doing the work and the object of the work. So the subject-object relationship. And there are tools, and there are also signs, what they call psychological instruments. I'm not going to get into this. And the other important basic idea here is to observe how the work is divided among the various actors. And typically, there are rules about the division of labor. So I was talking about the chain where everybody is very specialized. So that's one way of organizing work, by making people specialized. You could have another one where everybody could build the entire car, so they could maybe organize their work along different different divisions than their specialty. Of course, a well-known way of dividing labor is the hierarchy, where you have managers and etc. So in activity theory, when you analyze activity, you look at it at three levels that are called activity, actions, and operations. So activity is sort of the high level of how to respond to a need. You know, running a company means you need to be able to take order and to get payments and to issue, well, to ship the product and things like this. So activity is sort of the high level grain of analysis of why you're doing what you're doing. And then there's the level of the actions, which is the individual steps that people are taking to reach this goal, to sort of implement this activity. And so what they call actions is what is executed consciously to reach a goal that you've set to yourself. And the fact that it's the same word action as in action theory is actually, I'm not sure it's intentional, but it's the same type of thing we're talking about. But introduce another level, which I find interesting and quite important, which is the level of the operations. The thing is, when you do something repeatedly, in the beginning, you do them consciously, and at some point, it becomes automatic. So to take my favorite example, the first time you came here to campus, you know, you looked at instructions, and you were looking around and figuring out how to do things. And after a while, well, you figure out what was the best route for you, and now you do it without thinking. Unless, of course, there's some problem, which happens every day, as far as I can tell. But that's to keep you, you know, alert. but there's this notion that there's a bunch of things that you do without thinking, so unconsciously or rather semi-consciously. So the thing is, there are these transitions between the level of actions and operations, where the transition from an action to an operation is what they call automation or internalization, where again, something gets learned enough that you don't have to think about it anymore. But the reverse transition occurs when there's a problem. So, you know, you get to the station and there's a strike. So suddenly you have to think about what to do. Although there's going to be enough strikes that even that will become maybe an automation. I know in my case, you know, if I get to the train station and I see something wrong, I don't even think twice. I cross the street and I'm lucky enough that I have a parking garage with my car across the street and I can shift to the car. But it's also a case that something that you do automatically, you can also, through conceptualization, so taking a step back and reflecting on what you're doing, bring it back to the level of consciousness and maybe think of how to do it differently. Because even though you do it automatically, it's such a pain that you know you want to reflect on it and make it more efficient. And then there is a transition from activity to action, which the way I see it is more a sort of level of granularity at which you're doing the analysis. So in most papers on activity theory, you'll see this diagram of the triangle to explain that the relationship between the subject, so the actor doing actions and activities, and the object, the things that he is creating or manipulating, are mediated by what they call instruments. But it's also the case that the subject is not alone and is part of a community. And so if you look at the role of the community in that sort of management of activity, you'll find that the interaction between the subject and the community is mediated by rules that are decided, well, either by the community or by someone at the top, on how what is the role of each subject in the community. And the mediation between the community and the object is mediated itself by the notion of division of labor, on how we divide things among different types of activities, different types of tasks that then can be assigned to subjects. And in fact, if you look at these three corners here, instrument, rules, and division of labor, they're all these mediating things. And so you can imagine folding the three triangles on the sides here and making a pyramid where the top thing is the mediator of the idea that things are mediated. Anyway, that gets very theoretical, and I must say I don't fully understand all of it, but activity theory, beyond this, the theory, this theoretical discussion about these mediations, is an interesting and useful tool to analyze activity at the level of, say, an organization or a group, rather than individual activity. Okay, so that was kind of a super high level, right? Yeah, I know. I happened to spend 2 years in Denmark at the University of Aarhus, where Susanna Butker, I think her name was on the previous slide, yes? Susanna Butker, there, is, I think you could say she's the researcher really brought activity theory to HCI. Through her thesis, which actually was also published as a book, and it's called Through the Interface. And so between 1998 and 2000, I spent 2 years in Denmark in her lab, and I was trying to understand more about activity theory and about this notion of mediation, because having worked on instrumental interaction, there are obviously conceptual links between the two, and trying to understand how they apply activity theory in their participatory design process. But yeah, this is kind of abstract and requires some training, I guess, in the methods of social science and method of investigation that are specific to social science. So let me now try to get to things that are a little bit more concrete. I'm going to talk about Thomas Green's cognitive dimensions. So Thomas Green is a British researcher who has worked first on what was called the psychology of programming. So I guess this was in the, I would say, the 80s, maybe a little bit before, when the programming languages, a bunch of new programming languages came out, and the software industry was developing at a great pace. A number of psychologists were interested in looking at programmers from the perspective of observing the behavior and how programmers program, how they translate their ideas into code, and what is the role of the code in their what were the roles of the specific features of a programming language in the way they were programming. And so, and later on, this work on essentially, if you wish, the usability of programming languages was applied to more generally interactive systems. And so he insists that cognitive dimensions it's not a theory. For him, it's a notation, as I've described yesterday at the beginning. So it's a tool to help interaction designers better understand and keep track of things, and a way to evaluate a system according to certain criteria. And it's based on the psychology findings that the way we represent a problem is critical to our ability to solve that problem. And as you know, programming and computer science in general, it's all about representing things. And when yesterday I was talking about modeling in computer science is turning things into programs. And so it's inventing representations for things. When you have a problem and you decide where I'm going to use set of classes that are going to be organized in this way or that way, you're creating a representation, which is sometimes called an externalization, but I'm trying not to use that word. And so he observed how people were what people were doing when they use interactive systems, and trying to create a sort of a high-level taxonomy of the types of activities they do. The word activity here is not really the same as in activity theory, but sort of high-level, and I don't want to use the word tasks, so that's why I use activity. So high-level things you do when you interact with computers. And he came up with this six categories: incrementation, transcription, modification, exploration, search, and comprehension. And I think this is a actually useful list because it's short enough, and it does cover a lot, if not everything. Incrementation is when you add information to a system that is not already there. So you are adding data. You have to, maybe it comes from the outside world, maybe it's written on a sheet next to the computer, but you have to put it in the computer because it's not already there. Transcription is not exactly the same thing, and I think it's important to distinguish the two, is when you're copying from another source. So essentially, it's incrementation means that maybe you are, my example was not a very good one, actually. For incrementation, it's more that you're writing an essay. So you are inputting text that was not there before. It's only in your head, and it have to go from your head to the system. Transcription is you wrote down your essay on paper because you didn't have a computer, or maybe you prefer to do that because it's easier to for you, and then you have to enter it into the computer. So you have to turn it into this messy notes that you have into computer stuff. Modification is to changing stuff that is already there. It's also adapting it to a different problem, and we do that a lot. We take things we have done before and we reuse them. Exploration is sometimes you decide that you want to explore the capabilities of a system. you don't have necessarily a specific goal in mind, or you have a goal, but you want to explore the different possibilities to reach that goal. And the idea here is that you are in a trial and error mode. You're willing to try things that will not work, so you're not worried about, you know, being in a hurry or having a deadline or something. You want to explore, because through exploration, that's how you may learn new features. Search is search, looking for something you know is or maybe is not in the system and trying to find it. And then comprehension goes with exploration, is trying to discover some aspect of the system, again, to be able to use it better. And so these are based on observable observations of users. And I think it's when you design a system, it's a useful list to have somewhere in a corner to see to what extent your design supports this different type of tasks, right? Now, these are the types of activities, but the title there, Cognitive Dimensions, refers to different qualities of the interaction. So the definition there is a quote from one of the papers, I guess, aspects of the informational structure. So what they call informational structure is, for a programmer, it would be the code of the program. And for these researchers, that's put on the same level as the structure of the interface, the content of a form on a web page, or the way the information is put in shape for you to interact with or to interact through. And so these dimensions are the aspects of this structure that can be analyzed according to the activity you're trying to do, so one of the different activities. And so they have a fairly long list of dimensions, which again are good, are useful when you design, either as you design or more likely when you do what's called a walkthrough. After you've done a design, you want to look at it from different perspective. You want to sort of test it in a way. And these properties are quite useful to do one of these walkthroughs. Say, well, you know, how is the viscosity or visibility or premeasure commitment in the system, and can we improve it? So I'm not going to go through all of these. The one I particularly like among those is the first one, viscosity, the third one, premature commitment, and I would say hidden dependencies. But they're all important. It's just, I'm going to pick the three. So viscosity is a resistance to change. It's once you've done something, how hard is it to change your mind? So if you're typing text and you change your mind, you hit backspace and you can change text. That's easy. If you're programming, you know that, you know, if you want to change your mind about the name of a method or a class or a variable, it's a little bit more complicated. And that's why nowadays we have these IDEs. Yes, IDE. Integrated Development Environment, where they can change the name of a variable wherever it's used for you. So that reduces the viscosity. In the old days, when I started programming on punch cards, you didn't change variable names. And you used short ones. So that's a good way to think about how difficult things are, which you can measure, and we'll see models to do that, in fact, in a minute, which you can measure in terms of, well, how many steps does it take to do this task that should be simple, and maybe that is not as simple as it should be.
So in an ideal situation, viscosity should be less.
So less viscosity is better.
Ideally, it should be zero.
Yes. I'm not sure what the zero viscosity would be.
It will be, resistance will be zero for a change. change.
Well, but you know, if resistance is zero, it's dangerous. The reason we can ride a bike or even walk is because there is friction. If you are on an ice rink, it's a lot harder to walk. So if there's no resistance, it can be bad.
Yes, but in a system, in computer system.
Yeah, well, I don't have the equivalent of the ice rink for a computer system. But no, I don't think things are ever too easy to change. But the cases where you might want to think about it is that if a change is somewhat dangerous, right? And that gets into this whole idea that, you know, well, do I want to ask the user for a confirmation? But if I ask for confirmation, the person will get used to it. So you will get into this going from an action to an operation, from activity theory, where people instinctively, they say the dialog box, are you sure? Yes. Oops, shit. So sometimes you want some viscosity for good reasons. And I think this is really a fundamental rule of design, is no matter how meaningful and important and useful a rule is, there's always a case where it makes sense to break it. And the talent of the designer is to be good at knowing when to break a rule for good reasons. So yes, in general, you want to reduce... Oh, my turn. is to reduce viscosity, but sometimes you want to say, well, I'm going to make this a little bit harder because it's a dangerous operation, for example. Premature commitment. I think that's one that we suffer a lot from. Systems constrain you on some order of actions that doesn't match the order in which you would like to make those actions. I mentioned that before, the idea that you start creating something and you know you have to save it so you're sure to not lose it. And as you say save, it's asking you, well, what's the name of the file? And oftentimes, I don't know yet what the name of the file is going to be. I just want to make sure it's saved, right? And if I give the file a name, knowing that I will want to change it, then I can get into the viscosity where changing a file name can be, you know, it's more work. There is something in recent versions of the Mac OS that drive me crazy. It used to be that you were editing a file, and then you go into the Finder and change the name of the file. The document, open in Word or whatever, would change its name. It would know that you had changed the file name. And in some that's part of the problem. They don't all work the same. But these days, when you do this kind of thing, it gets confused on the editor side where, oh, your file is gone. No, I just changed its name. So these are all these little things that are really annoying. And it's not just that they're annoying, that they cause errors, and that they frustrate people. But they tell people, don't trust the system. And so if they don't trust the system, they're going to not trust it for this, but for nothing else, and then it will really affect the way they are willing to explore and do other things. So premature commitment, every time you impose an order for things, you should ask yourself, where am I doing this because it's easier for me as a designer, or because it will be easier for the programmer to program this? Or is there really a good reason for the user to be forced to follow these steps? And the last one is that I'll talk about is hidden dependencies. There are lots of things that are happening in the system where there are hidden links that I'm not aware of. That means that something that I think should be possible is not possible because of these dependencies. And for example, what I was just saying between the name of the file and the fact that it's open in a window, clearly there's something hidden from me here that makes it difficult for the system to change the name while the document is open. If that's the case, if you have a dependency, you should make it visible, which goes to the item number 2 here, visibility, rather than trying to hide it. If you hide it, it really has to be hidden, and the user should not have to know. Anyway, the other ones are harder to explain in a few words, and I encourage you to go to the paper to see more example. Okay, so this was a very small sample of. Are we going to get rid of the bug? Yes or no? I don't know. I don't think it's going to find the exit this way, but that's. I'm not a wasp, I don't know. Aha, it's flying again. No, wrong way. Go there. All right, I'll open the window again. It's funny how a tiny little thing can distract an entire class. Okay, so this was a small sample of theories and models and notations coming from the field of psychology and social sciences in general. Now I want to get to a set of models, and well, I don't think I would use the word theories there, that are really the result of work by HCI researchers. And even though some may have been influenced by other fields, they were really created for HCI. So the first one is an analysis of the morphology of input devices. So this is a work that was done by Card, McKinley, and Robertson. Three people who were working at the famous, come on, you all know it. Xerox, yes. That was done, I think, late 80s, probably, maybe early 90s. The idea was to try to describe the properties of input devices so you could analyze collections of input devices and make informed choices. So they decided that, well, what is an input device in the first place? And an input device is something that is a transducer. So it's translating physical properties like the position of a thing or the amount of force you exert on it or the movement how much you move it. So physical properties into logical ones, like what is the position of the cursor on the screen. And so they describe a transducer by these various not properties, because I want to create a confusion, different characteristics. One is what kind of manipulation of the device is actually sensed by the device. Is it just its position? Is it the force? Is it an absolute position or a change of position? Are you measuring changes in linear dimensions or rotational ones? So if it's position, they call it P, force is F, and whether if it's absolute, it's going to be P and F, and if it's relative, it's changes in P, dP, and changes in F, dF. And if it's linear or circular, you can track X, Y, and Z maybe in 3D, and circular is going to be the three rotational angles. Then there's an input domain. What is a range of values that these measures can take? There's also the output domain. What is the output of the transformation? There is a resolution function. How many different values can you measure in that interval? Current state of the device. That's for things like, is a button up or down? And there may be other properties because they wanted to leave the things open. And then the idea was to say, well, you know, a device, an input device can actually be a combination of multiple devices. And they had three rules for composing things: merge, layout, and connect. So merge is when you physically merge the different devices into one. So if you look at a three-button mouse, well, it is, in fact, a thing that tracks movement horizontally, combined with another one that tracks movement, well, not vertically like that, vertically like that. well, in the two orthogonal dimensions. So that's why we have a merge here. Then you have three buttons, which are, you know, the buttons, they could be separate from the mouse, but they are on the mouse. So this is what they call a layout. We've decided to take the three buttons as independent devices and stick them onto the mouse. And that makes my mouse. But the input device is really the combination of the mouse and the cursor on the screen, right? And so the cursor on the screen is its own device. And here they have this connect relationship that says, well, we connect the position as calculated by the mouse with the cursor on the screen. Now, why would you do that? The thing is, nowadays, you know, the range of devices we use is actually, well, tempted to say it's both small and large. For input, using mouse, using a trackpad, and that's pretty much it. But there was a time where there were trackballs, and there were joysticks, and there were force joysticks, and there were a 3D mouse, and all sorts of other devices. And so the idea was that, of course, we wanted to create software that did not depend on the actual device that you had. And so having a language, this is a language, described input device, could help make software better adapt to the actual device. So this is an example from their paper, which I find every year it's getting more and more out of sync with you guys. This is a radio. Have you ever seen a radio in your life? So there used to be a time where we had, you know, these boxes with buttons on them, where you could turn a button for the sound volume. You could select if you wanted to have AM or FM, and then they have this big dial that would move a hand here in front of that display to select the wavelengths, I guess, of the radio emitting. Yes? Yeah, well, you've heard of it, right? From your grandparents. Well, anyway, they take this example to say, well, there is this volume button, so it's tracking rotation around the Z axis. If you assume Z is sticking out of the screen here, volume is going between 0 and 270 degrees. The state is the current setting, the angle R. The resolution, well, they say it's a function that is mapping its identity, in fact, mapping the output to something between 0 and 270. And then this is connected to, well, the innards of the radio and controls the output volume between 0 and the function C times the angle. Although I doubt it's a linear mapping to decibels, because decibel is the logarithmic scale, so I don't think that's as simple. The selector here, it has three positions, so the angle can be between 0 and 90 degrees, but there's only three values in output that you can set, so 0, 45, and 90. So it's a discrete selector, and it's going to be mapped to whichever, to one of these three settings. And then there is the thing to select the station, so here, what's important is not the absolute position, but how much you turn the dial by, which itself controls the something similar to a cursor, but in 1D, along this linear dimension. And the cursor has a horizontal position on the X axis between 0, and they say 5 here, I don't know why 5, but anyway, and that controls the frequency to which you tune your radio. And so if you want to represent this device, you can do it like this, in this chart, where you have each cell here represent a type of sensing position or change of position, meaning movement, or force, or change of force, either in X, Y, or Z, for linear dimensions, or rotational X, Y, and Z for rotary ones. In which case, if you are on the rotary side, it's not position, it's angle, it's not force, it's torque. And so if you put all the devices that we saw in the previous slide on here, well, the mouse, which was in the first slide, it's tracking things in X and Y connected by this, what was it called? It's not layout. It's merge. So it's merging, sensing an X and a Y. And here there is a layout, meaning on top of it there is something sensing movement in Z, which is the 3 buttons. And on top of that, within each cell here, depending on where you put it, left to right, represents the resolution that you have. So in X and Y, you have a very, well, pretty high resolution of, you know, how many, with the sensitivity with which you measure movements. But for the buttons, there are 3 buttons, and they are essentially on or off. So there is no measure of how hard you are pressing the button or how much you are pushing the button. And then if you look at the radio station, well, the volume is rotational along Z and has high resolution. The selector between AM and FM is also around the Z axis, but has very few values, only 3. And then the controlling the frequency is done with the rotary dial connected to the linear thing of the frequency selector. So this lets you represent these things. And why is that interesting, you may ask? Well, this is the next diagram in the paper. And what they looked at the number of devices that were out there at the time. And at the time, as you can see, there were a lot of things. some are still with us. Some have disappeared. And there are some new ones. So I'm not going to go through all of them. But what's interesting in this diagram is that you see there's a lot of devices that track position. So a tablet, a light pen, a touch panel, a touch screen, cursors on sliders. Well, the Polymus Cube is a weird device. There are only a few that track changes in position, but there's the important mouse in there. Some track force, and none was tracking changes in force. So the other thing is a lot of them are X and Y. A few of them are X, Y, and Z. And if you look at rotational things, there's actually quite a number in there. So joystick, for example, they move around a central point, so they track a rotational movement. But what else? We have trackballs also, which are turning onto themselves, and a few more weird devices in there. Now, the reason it's interesting to do this type of exercise, not necessarily with this exact set of columns, but something we often do is we create what we call a design space. A design space is, for a particular problem, we analyze the properties that are important, and we look at things that have been done and where they fit in that space, and then we look at where are the holes. Where are things that have not been tried yet? And maybe there are good reasons because they are a stupid idea, but maybe there are things that people missed because they didn't think of it in that space. So is it interesting to do devices that track changes in pressure? Well, interestingly, a lot of modern devices track pressure, not just contact in terms of touch, but changes in pressure. I don't see any. I see a laptop with the track point device, the mini joystick in the middle of the keyboard. You don't like it? So everybody knows what I'm talking about. So why or why did they do that? So so I'm not sure of the name anymore. Was it the? I think it was TrackPoint. But doesn't sound quite right. So the idea was to have a very small joystick, really, in the middle of the keyboard between the typically letters, yeah, Y and U and H and so have it there. And instead of being a joystick that reacts to changes in position, like, you know, a real joystick, a game paddle, it was reacting to force, how much you pushed it. The thing itself did not move, but it was sensitive to how much force you apply to it. And then there was a very elaborated transfer function to transform this force into the speed of motion of the cursor. So this was invented by a researcher named Ted Selker at IBM. He did a lot and a lot of work to fine-tune it. And it's a device that, yes, requires, you know, practice. The first time you try to push it, you know, it's not moving, and then suddenly, boom, your cursor is gone. So it can be frustrating. But I think it was quite a clever design at a time where, for one reason or another, the trackpads were very small and not very precise. I think the technology, passive capacitive technology in particular, was not as good as it is today. And it also enabled to have this joystick embedded in smaller devices, so you didn't need much room because it was not taking additional room if you already had a keyboard. So the point here is that creating this kind of design spaces is very useful to analyze a problem and analyze the possible solutions and not get stuck into, well, doing a small variant of something that has already been done and exploring things that have not been explored. Okay, I'm tempted here, given the time, since we only have another half hour, right? Not 15 minutes. I'm going to skip for today UAN and state machines because I want to talk about GOMS today, and I'll get back to the one I skipped next time, especially since next time is, 3 weeks from now, right? Okay, so GOMS. So the GOMS series of models was created by the same card we talked about before, Stu Card, Tom Moran and Alan Newell. And that was really the idea of taking knowledge from psychology and trying to turn it into a model that is not just descriptive, but also predictive. Because in HCI, we spend a lot of time running experiments or running tests, measuring the time it takes to do this or do that with real users, because we don't have predictive models. So if we have predictive models, we can run the models and make the calculation and figure out, you know, this is better than that without having to run a test with 100 participants. So the GOMS family of models, so GOMS means goals, operators, methods, and selection rules. These models are about describing interaction at the right level of abstraction. You remember, a model needs to abstract from reality. So at the right level of abstraction, so you can hope to make reasonable predictions about essentially the time it takes to do a particular task. And so GOMS is both a method to describe these tasks, so then you can make predictive measures, and the set of models to manipulate or operate on these tasks. So in a sense, they are influenced by task analysis techniques, but GOMS relies on a model called the human model processor, which is an information processing model of how our brain processes information. And I'm not going to go into that today. So the idea is that you want to analyze interaction in terms of a set of goals, what the user wants to do. So I want to, for example, replace this piece of text in my text by another one. The operators, the set of elementary actions or operations supported by the software, what the software can do. So I can erase text, I can insert text, I can select, I can... So all the basic operations you can do. Then the methods that are sort of the recipes that people have hopefully learned to reach a goal from a sequence of sub-goals. So I know that if I need to, if I want to create a new file where I need to launch the word processor and then go into the file menu and open and say create new there, and maybe it will ask me for a name and then I have my new document. So it's all this sequence of steps that are learned. And in general, to achieve a particular goal, there's different sequences that can be used. So you all know that you can select text with the mouse or trackpad or whatever. You can also select text with the arrow keys and doing shift or control or something. You can delete text by going into the edit menu and saying cut, or you can use a keyboard shortcut, or I don't know, maybe you could drag it to the trash. So we have all these things in our heads of different ways of doing basic things. And then there is the selection rules, which is how do you pick one method among another, right? So the idea with GOMS is that you're going to describe the operators, the methods. The selection rule oftentimes will be pick the fastest one for the particular situation. And then from that, if we can put a prediction of the time it takes for the individual operators, we will be able to make a prediction for the overall task. So here is an example. I want to edit text. And my sub-goal is just to select the piece of text before I move it elsewhere. The basic operators I have are moving the mouse, clicking without a K, the mouse button, or typing keys on the keyboard. Okay? Something fairly basic. Now, the methods I have is, in order to edit text, which was the initial high-level goal of which selecting is part of it, to edit text, well, maybe I delete the whole sentence and I retype it, or maybe I retype it elsewhere, because my goal, again, is to move a text elsewhere. Or maybe I can do cut and paste with the keyboard shortcuts, or I can do cut and paste with the menus. And for the subtask of selecting text, well, I can click at the beginning and drag to the end of the text, or I can double-click the first word and then shift-click the last word, right? Now, you all do this every day, and you all spontaneously use one of these methods without even thinking, right? Now, the thing is, typically, if you know your software well enough, you're going to pick the method that is the fastest given the particular context. So the selection rules here could be like for editing, well, if it takes really short, I find it ridiculous that I'm erasing something and retyping it, but somehow it felt faster than doing, you know, more complicated sequences of things. So if the text is short, I will pick method one. If I know the shortcut, well, with cut and paste, of course, a lot of people know, but I see a lot of people still using the menus. So if I know the shortcuts, I will use the method two with keyboard shortcuts. And if not, I'll use method three. And then for selection, I'm going to click and drag if it's not too long a drag. But if I want to select a long piece of text, I'm going to select the beginning and then go to the end and then shift select at the end, right? Because even though I could do the drag and have the automatic scrolling kick in and all that, I know from experience that something's going to happen, right? Either it's going to scroll too fast and I miss the end and et cetera. So I've learned that this method is better. Method five is better for long text. Okay, so these are the ingredients of GOMS. Now, GOMS was meant to have different types of models, but the most famous ones, in the sense that it's the one that's been the most developed and used and proven useful, is called KLM. So KLM is a keystroke level model, so it's looking at interaction at a low level. And here, the idea is that the operators that we had in the previous slides, we're going to denote them by letters, so key for typing a key or hitting a button on the mouse, P for pointing, H, homing. This is moving your hand from the keyboard to the mouse or from the mouse to the keyboard, which takes time. D for drawing a line segment, even though here we're doing text editing, so it doesn't come into play. And then there's a magic operator. I think M should be for magic rather than mental. but they call it mental activity. And they observe that, you know, people need time to plan their actions. And so the system is doing nothing. You're entering nothing, but you're just planning your next actions. And so the idea is that from the previous slides, if I apply method 5, then method 3, for the selection, I'm going to move the mouse. First I'm going to think, what am I going to do next? So M. Then I need to point to the beginning of the text. Then I need to do a click to select the beginning. Then I go to the end, so I'm assuming there is no scrolling involved there here, because if there were scrolling, I would need additional operators to represent scrolling. So I move to the end, and then I click again. Copying, mental operation, going to the menu bar, point, click, get the menu appear, point down to the item, click again. Selecting the destination, moving to the destination and clicking the destination, and then paste. Is the same sequence as copy. Now, here for each of these operators, they've given us, through measuring with real users, estimates of the time it takes for each of these operators. So hitting a key, it depends. It can be slow or fast depending on whether you know where the key is. So they take a mean of 0.40 seconds, which I think is super high. Pointing, of course, we could use Fitts' law, but to use Fitts' law, it assumes you know the distances and the sizes of targets. So if you don't have all this detailed information about your particular interface, they say, well, use an average of 1.10 seconds. Homing is 1 second. My favorite one is mental activity, which is 1.35 seconds. So they measured it to the hundredth of a second. But again, these are estimates. And so if I take this little simple operation of selecting some text, cutting it, moving the cursor elsewhere, and pasting, it says it's going to take 15 seconds. Yes?
Is the goal of the KLM to find the time or just to disseminate the operators?
To disseminate?
Yeah.
The purpose here is predictive, predicting the time it takes to do this task and giving you a tool to compare different ways of doing the same thing so you can figure out which one is the fastest. Because in general, that's the one we prefer. So it's purely predictive. But of course, to do that, you need to identify the operators. So the thing is, that seems unrealistically long. And in general, the predictions are overestimates. However, when you compare different techniques, the ranking you get of the techniques is pretty accurate. In other words, it overestimates, but it overestimates for everyone. So the differences, the relationships, the order of different methods, if you compare different things, are likely to be what you would observe in real use.
So it's useful for comparing some different variations of the interface?
Yes. Yeah.
That's the main reason, yeah?
Yes. But it's I mean, I have to say, it's the only predictive tool that we have. You know, if you read any paper in the literature of HCI, it always, not always, but a lot of them end up with, we ran an experiment, we brought 13 subjects, and we asked them to do this, and then we measured the time it took, and then we do statistics, and we say, well, this one was fastest, right? Now, of course, there's a little bit of black magic going on with the magical operator. Where do you put the M? I mean, here there's an M before you start selecting, before you start doing the copy, before you go to the destination, before you paste. I think that would be for someone, for a very inexperienced user. An experienced user will you know, chunk these things and do an M at the beginning, and then the rest is almost automatic. But in fact, you can play with these different ways of modeling things and see, in fact, differences between trained and non-trained users, how it would affect the performance itself, but how different methods would, whether the order of performance would change or not. Now, there have been attempts to refine this model. So one example is the, well, it's going to be in the next slide, but you can add operators. Of course, you can avoid doing things by hand if you have a system that would do the computation for you and select the methods, for example, automatically to select the most efficient one. And so you can show things that, you know, the way people spontaneously shift from selecting with the cursor only versus selecting with the mouse, in fact, correspond to the point where the mouse becomes more efficient if you want to do a bigger movement, for example, than just hitting the cursor key. So it sort of gives you, in a sense, a reasonable model to describe this type of things. Now, as I said, it tends to overestimate execution times. And as we saw, the operators have a fixed duration, which is not realistic. But you could imagine refining that. And in fact, to close, because I have another full 2 minutes, there is a more recent version of GOMS called CPM GOMS by Bonnie John. Bonnie John is a researcher who has done a lot of her work in that area, where they did a much more refined model based on a more refined model of the cognitive processes that go on in your head when you do this type of tasks. So the idea is that you have parallel processing between perceptual processes, what you see, cognitive, planning what you're going to do next, and motor activities, moving your limbs to, you know, point and click and do these things. And so this can be turned into a PERT diagram. And so they are able to describe tasks like the ones we're talking about, like pointing and clicking, with a diagram where you see what's happening in the visual system, in the cognitive system, with the right hand, with the, well, here there's no left hand, the eye movements, and then the world, which is the reaction time for the system. And so they create this diagram where, well, you know, your right hand starts moving the cursor, and at some point you perceive the target, and so you initiate acquisition of the target, and you have all these time dependencies. These are minimum and maximum times. You know what a PERT diagram is, right? It's a succession of tasks that have time dependencies and time constraints. And what you try to look is what's called the critical path, meaning doing the things as early as possible given all the constraints, and to find what is the minimum time it would take. And their assumption is that we do this spontaneously. We optimize things to do things in the least possible time. And they applied this to a, well, arguably very simple task, which is getting to an ATM and entering your PIN number. They have, you know, there's a card slot. You enter your PIN here. You say withdraw from checking's account, $80, you push some buttons, etc. And so they showed here that the measured time from two subjects, S1 and S2, S1 is orange, S2 is green, compared to their model, the one I showed in the other slide, is plotted with the triangles here, is, you know, very accurate. I mean, it's quite remarkable, I would say. And they created a tool called Apex to automate the creation of those diagrams. Now, the thing here is we see what I was saying at the very beginning of this class yesterday is this notion of trade-off between precision and level of abstraction. To be able to go to that level of precision in the prediction, you need to go to that level of description of your model. I don't know how to do this diagram, right? And this is for a super simple task, you know, entering your PIN number and getting money off an ATM. So that illustrates the gap that we still have between being able to have accurate predictive models that are usable in practice. And that, to me, tells me there is more research to be done to try to get these tools more advanced so we can push forward and have more predictive models. Because the way we do HCI these days is, it's not a science, it's an art, right? You try, you fail, you test, you measure, and there's very little that helps you actually make this in an efficient way. Well, okay, I'm going to stop here. Do you have any questions? I don't know our friends are. Convinced by gums? Now, if you have had the curiosity to look at some of the previous year's exams,
yes.
You may have noticed some patterns. Yes? No? The good thing about gums is that it's a really good one to give exam exercises on. Just saying. Anyway, that's part of the reason why I teach it, of course. In the exams, as you will see, and I cannot guarantee that I will follow the same pattern because, I don't know, maybe I'll suddenly will get bored of having done the same thing several years in a row. But usually there's a set of questions with multiple choices or with one-line answers. And that should take you 5 minutes. Maybe not, but... And then there's typically two exercises. One is more on something around modeling things with this type of things, or something around Fitts' law, because there's also things that we can easily turn into a small exercise. And then there's one that is more towards a design exercise around conceptual modeling. So... You have been warned. No, not this one. No. When well, you never know. Maybe I'll go crazy, but it will make my life of grading it much harder too. So no, I'm talking more about this kind of things here. Okay, well, I think you can take a 10-minute breaks and 10 minutes break. and then go on for the TA.